From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Socialism has become the new old bogeyman of the conservative moneyed classes in the U.S. The fear of socialism stems directly from its growing popularity among those left behind by our current capitalist system. The ideas behind socialism and capitalism go back centuries, and most of us today lack a clear understanding of these systems. Now, one of the leading Marxist economists in the U.S. has written a new book exploring the ideas of Karl Marx. It has been more than 200 years since Marx's birth, more than 170 years since the publication of his book, The Communist Manifesto, with Friedrich Engels, and more than 150 years since his own seminal and influential book, Das Kapital. Yet Marx remains misunderstood to this day. Richard Wolff is a visiting professor at the New School University in New York, a professor of economics emeritus at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and the author of a number of books, including Democracy at Work, A Cure for Capitalism, Occupy the Economy, Challenging Capitalism, Imagine Living in a Socialist USA, and Capitalism's Crisis Deepens, Essays on the Global Economic Meltdown. He now joins me to discuss his latest book called simply Understanding Marxism. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Sonali. Glad to be here.
So immediately when I started looking through your book, three questions jumped out at me, which is, how does one define Marxism? What is the difference between Marxism and socialism? And was Marx a Marxist? So I'm not going to throw all three of those at you at once, but let's just start with the idea of defining Marxism, since your book is specifically about that. This is a term based on one particular individual named Marx. So what is Marxism?
Well, the best way to describe it is a kind of tradition of thinking that goes back to the work of Karl Marx. He was born in 1818, he died in 1883. In other words, he lived across the 19th century. He was not the first socialist or communist by a long shot. He came after that kind of movement had already gotten underway, but he became the kind of seminal thinker who produced a great deal of work, essays, books of all kinds. And so, basically, it's the most developed tradition of thought within and about socialism and capitalism and how they differ that we have. And it has been inspirational on a scale that is really stunning. You don't have very many examples in the history of the world like this. He was born in Germany, but because he became politically active as a young man, he was exiled from Germany and actually spent most of his life in London, working with and in the English language and producing an extraordinary volume of work. But what's really interesting is that it must have been the right work at the right time, because it spread, as I say, extraordinarily. Even in his lifetime, much of Europe and beyond that, places like the United States and the British colonies were catching on to his work. In the 100 years, a little over 100 years since he died, his work has spread to every country on the face of the earth. There are Marxist associations, Marxist political movements, Marxist political parties, and, for example, the government of the largest by population country on earth, the People's Republic of China, is officially a Marxist government. So it has spread all over the world. Of course, if you spread in a short time, and 100 or 125 years is, believe me, a very short time historically, and you spread across the world all these different histories and cultures and economic conditions, you end up, as has happened to many traditions, with alternative interpretations of what Marx wrote. That's why I use the word tradition, because it includes people who disagree with one another, often quite considerably. It's a little bit like talking about the Christian tradition, because there are different kinds of interpretations of the Bible, for example, different understandings, debates and disagreements. You have all of that inside Marxism too. But if I could very briefly define it, it's the notion that the history of the world is comprised of a sequence of economic systems, that human beings have approached economic systems pretty much the way they've approached everything else. They are grateful for what they have, but they're always looking for a way to do it better. That's why we evolved our political systems, our educational systems, our family systems. And the notion of Marxism is the economic systems, likewise, are a kind of trial and error. And that capitalism, being the most recent one, ought to be confronted with the same intellectual curiosity, the same notion of asking the question, can we do better than what we've inherited from the past? And the basic Marxian answer is an enthusiastic yes. Capitalism should not be thought of as the end of history, the point at which we no longer ask these questions. The notion of Marxism is, let's take a look at capitalism and let's figure out whether we need another system, what it might look like, and how we're going to get there.
So Marx's critique of capitalism, as we call Marxism now, one might argue, was crafted at a very different time. You know, in the 1800s, you didn't have the same kind of successes of capitalism or achievements of capitalism that hardcore capitalist defenders like to tout, and that they might say you can't apply those same critiques today. But can you?
Well, I would argue that they're right. You can't apply the same critiques. But Mr. Marx was one of those seminal thinkers that kind of understood things on a scale that even though the details change and the context changes, there are some basic insights. For example, in conventional economics, as it's taught in American universities, students are required to read the works, for example, of Adam Smith or David Ricardo or John Stuart Mill, or more recently, John Maynard Keynes, or even more recently, Paul Samuelson. It's not that the conditions haven't changed since those people wrote, for sure they have, but that there is the conviction that their level of insight is a very good place to start. And so all that the Marxian tradition has done is used Marx's work as a starting point, but never being satisfied in some general way with the original insights. It's a matter of interpreting and then adjusting and updating them to see what kinds of insights they can provide to the problems of capitalism now.
So Marx's critique of capitalism hit a strong nerve during his lifetime, which is why his work became so influential. Are you finding that today that those same critiques are hitting a nerve? Are people rediscovering Marx and Marxism? Are they looking back at those critiques and realizing that many of them do apply today, that that interest, that resurgence of interest in socialism is spreading to, you know, towards people who are looking up, who was Karl Marx?
Exactly. That's one of the reasons I wrote this book, because so many people were asking me, either through my radio and TV programs or in my public speaking. Yes, absolutely. The renewal of interest in socialism is leading people, as anyone who studies this material knew it would, to the greatest thinker that we ever had in this field, which is Marx, and the many thinkers since then who have acknowledged with intellectual honesty the influence upon them and their work of what they got from reading Marx and some of the leading Marxists since. So yes, and I expect that very much to continue. And the reasons, by the way, might be important to understand. Has capitalism changed? For sure. But does capitalism exhibit some of the basic reasons why Marx himself became a critic? And the answer is likewise, sure. And let me mention just two. Capitalism produces a stunning level of inequality. Today, Mr. Jeffrey Bezos, the CEO of Amazon, boasts that he has a personal fortune of $150 billion. That's more wealth than many countries around the world have. This is a level of inequality that you'd have to go back to ancient Egypt and the pharaohs to get that again. Capitalism, instead of making us less unequal, has demonstrated that it is a system prone to extraordinary inequality. Oxfam in England released a report recently indicating that the richest 100 people on this planet together have more wealth than the bottom half of the population of the planet, roughly 3.5 billion people. This is an extraordinary situation. Marx was very critical of the inequality reproduced by capitalism. And the other big issue for Marx was capitalism's instability. You know, we had a great crash in the 1930s. Now we've had another great crash starting in 2008, and the effects of that are with us right as we speak. Marx also points out that capitalism, wherever it settles, has a cycle. Every 4 to 7 years, it tanks. Millions of people are thrown out of work. Thousands of enterprises go belly up. Poverty stalks the countryside. Inequality worsens. This is a system whose inequality and instability should long ago have projected onto the mass of people the importance of asking the question, can we do better? And to that question, Marxism as a tradition remains one of the great resources for answers.
So when he was critiquing capitalism, he applied that critique to feudalism and slavery institutions that still existed at the time when he was writing. And so today we might be able to expand that same analysis to what we sometimes call wage slavery, right?
Right. Marx enjoyed using that phrase because he wanted to, in a short, pithy kind of way, get across to people that there were similarities between capitalism, feudalism, and slavery, which, if you faced them, would help you understand both the need for and the possibility of going further. Let me briefly explain. Slavery is a system that organizes the production of goods and services into two basic roles, master, slave. The slave does all the work, and the master controls it all and takes the output, returning to the slave enough to keep the slave going because he wants this system to reproduce itself over time. Feudalism does not allow one person to own another, as we did have in slavery, but feudalism is like slavery in, again, dividing the people engaged in the production of goods and services into two roles, lord and serf. The serfs do all the work. The lords live in the luxurious homes that is part of the work that the serfs have to do. Now we come to capitalism. When it came into existence, basically starting in England back in the 16th and 17th centuries, it pretended, and I believe it was an honest effort. I don't mean pretense in the sense of deliberately saying something that isn't true, but they thought at that time that they were putting behind them this dichotomy, slave, master, serf, lord. But the irony, and this is one of Marx's insights, is that capitalism thought it was breaking from those systems, but it wasn't in reality. It was just changing the form. In capitalism, you don't have master-slave, you don't have lord and serf, but you have the rough equivalent, namely employer and employee. The employer directs and controls, the employer gets the profits, even though everybody, especially the employees, have done the work to produce those profits, but we allow them to be taken by a very small subset of the people involved in production. And that's pretty much what slavery and feudalism did as well. And that's Marx's way of saying, look, the employee is a wage slave, suggesting, as he wanted to, that we see in capitalism not the end of human history, but another phase of a dichotomy between those who control and those who are controlled, which is the problem. We have to get beyond it. And Marx points the direction, that's all he really does, points the direction of what it might mean to go beyond a system like capitalism, whose employer-employee relationship account for the inequality that it constantly reproduces and the instability that attends the system.
Right. I mean, essentially, it's by design that inequality is baked into the system. And I just want to read from your book where you explain that so well. You write, the employer believes that employing you, as with all other productive laborers hired, will add quality and or quantity to the enterprise's output of ladders and thus more sales revenue as well. So Marx explains, an employer will only pay a productive worker $20 an hour if during that hour, more than $20 worth of sales revenue results. And so we essentially have baked into that an inequality between employer and employee. So the defenders of capitalism, Richard, would say, well, the employee is welcome to start their own enterprise and exploit those below him or her. And that's how you get innovation and creation, and greed drives society and progress, and you can't have it any other way.
Yes, you know, that's really interesting, because those arguments were made in Marx's time. And for better or worse, we do have Marx's response. He was a sharp debater and went right after those folks. And in regard to the notion of greed and so forth as an incentive, Marx was very clever and referred to that often as an insult to the human race, the notion that the only reason human beings try to figure out better ways to do things would be if they could personally profit from doing so. And he mocked all of that and made reference to the abundant anthropological literature at that time, showing that every kind of society for which we have any kind of record indicates that human beings had a tendency to try to do things better, to learn to use tools, to learn to use machines, to develop cooperation, because they understood that if they cooperated with one another, they'd all be better off, rather than cooperating to get one person better off. In other words, the notion that you have to have a capitalist system to have economic development may be very comforting to capitalists, but it has no grounding in the history of the human race, and is a kind of an insult that imagines human beings never thought in terms of community, never thought in terms of teamwork. And Marx, and I myself, I follow in this particular way, I always find it remarkable that the same people who will go to a sports event and really enjoy and understand and celebrate something they call teamwork, then seem to imagine that it couldn't be other than the opposite of that in the world of economics, where everybody has to be motivated only by their own immediate personal advantage relative to other people. And I also think that, you know, that if you look at the historical record, many of the great inventions that we are now taking for granted were produced by people who didn't anticipate and did not get very much in the way of personal advancement or gain from what they did, but had instead an aesthetic satisfaction, a sense of community involvement, a sense of giving back to the community that educated and nurtured them as children. All the complex motives that make people be and do what they do are a testimony to the narrow apologetics that imagine you can only get human progress if you make people personally, selfishly motivated.
Now, Richard, the defenders of capitalism have said and still say that they, thinking of so many Republicans who are very frightened of socialism today, they say, well, we don't, these socialists want to redistribute wealth so that everybody gets a smaller piece of the pie. We want to grow the pie. We want a rising tide lifts all boat. And there's this notion that capitalism increases the wealth of society so that all the surpluses that are created trickle down to the rest of us. I guess we were sold that same bill of lies about the tax reform bill, which now we know that corporations took all of their benefits from government intervention and kept them, put them in offshore accounts, didn't create jobs with them. How do the defenders of capitalism continue to justify this system when it's so clear that the surpluses simply get stored and they build bigger and bigger mountains of wealth like Bezos, who you're mentioning?
Yes, I think it's in a way the key question that you're asking. How do they hold on? Let me comment a little bit as follows. I was struck recently by an NBC Wall Street Journal poll that found that 25% of voters today believe that if a candidate running for office says that he or she is a socialist, that's a plus. In other words, they're attracted to a candidate who says that. The reason I was struck by that is that we are citizens of a country that has demonized everything having to do with socialism uninterruptedly for the last 75 years, just short of a century. With the end of World War II in 1945, that demonization got going on a stunning scale. And what it has done is kind of produced a black and white universe, particularly for the older people in our society, who believe that sort of everything bad is associated with socialism and everything good is associated with capitalism. That's the fruit of the Cold War. You kind of had the reverse absurdity over there in the Soviet Union, and for the same parallel kinds of reasons. Normal human being, when they realize or they think about economics, are looking for the strengths and the weaknesses. Let's have an intelligent conversation about the strengths and weaknesses of one system, capitalism, and compare it to the strengths and weaknesses of another system, socialism, communism, whatever you like. And then let's make an evaluation. That would be the reasonable way to go forward. But in the tensions of the Cold War, all of that was thrown aside so that you didn't look at the details, you didn't face the facts. You constantly reassured yourself in the United States that communism is bad and capitalism is good, and in the Soviet Union, vice versa. I think the irony here is that a new generation rising up, a generation that did not live in the Cold War, that never went through the transformation of having the Soviet Union be the ally of the United States fighting fascism in World War II to become the arch enemy literally within months after the end of the war, never went through any of that, was recently pointed out to me that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was born after the Cold War, or literally as the Cold War was ending. So her entire formation and that of the generation she's a part of is brought up without the hysterical black and white kind of mentality that we had. And the older you go in American society, all the polls show that, the more thinking of capitalism versus socialism as a displacement of the question good versus bad, that's something that older you get, the more you get it. And the younger you go in our population, the less likelihood is of seeing that.
Right.
And let me drive it home with one particular example. You know, there are many criticisms that can be made and should be made, both of the Soviet Union before and of the People's Republic of China now. Those are in order, like criticisms of any system should be put forward, and they can be done and they can be made, and they have things about their society that need criticism. Many of the people in those societies voice such criticism. But here's a simple fact, which I, as an economist, cannot pretend is not the case. In the 20th century, the most spectacular example of economic growth, going from being a poor country to being a much, much richer country in a relatively short amount of time, the number one example in the 20th century is the Soviet Union. And in the 21st century, the 20 years that we have of that century up until this moment, the most spectacular example is the People's Republic of China. You can jump up and down and you can say what you want, but in the pressure to go from poverty to comfort, to have a standard of living that is enables you to educate your children and lead a healthy life, these societies have achieved something that puts them on the map of something to be taken seriously and not to be dismissed by some old ideological either-or-ness that wasn't a good idea back then and is downright ridiculous now.
Right. So finally, Richard, it seems as though the only way that in the United States we can dismiss socialism or Marxism is through propaganda, which is exactly what the Red Scare was all about. And we're seeing that revived again today with the critiques of socialism, you know, this massive fear that they're sowing about the Green New Deal. There won't be any planes. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is coming for your hamburgers. They're going to kill all the cows. And of course, the base laps it up, the base of the conservatives and Trump and others laps up these lies. So it seems as the only way to really undermine socialism and Marxist critique of capitalism is through propaganda and lies.
Yeah, it is. It's a very interesting revival by Mr. Trump, who is older and comes out of that generation, of the old Cold War patterns. But I really do feel, and it's not just wishful thinking, that with young people, and you know, I continue to teach in the university, so I'm constantly talking to people in the ages of 18 to 25. Among young people, what is hard reality for them is that the capitalist system isn't working. They're not seeing the kinds of jobs they hoped for. They're loading up with debts they cannot afford. They're surrounded by political actors who inspire disgust, not respect. For them, capitalism isn't working. And whatever else you say, they want to see alternatives and they want to think about them. And the reason interest in socialism and Marxism are rising is because they have the traditional alternatives to offer, the traditional criticisms to offer, and that is speaking to the younger people. And by younger, I'm now talking about roughly the younger half of the population. So Mr. Trump and his allies are repeating old stories, but the passage of time is removing the audience for those stories while it's building the audience for what the book Understanding Marxism is trying to get across.
Richard, thank you as always for joining us and spending this time with us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sonali, and I appreciate your interest in this kind of work.
My guest has been Richard Wolff, visiting professor at the New School University, New York, professor of economics emeritus at UMass Amherst. He's written a number of books, and we've been discussing his latest called Simply Understanding Marxism. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.